Hey, everybody. Michael Thiessen here for Liberty Coalition Canada. It's my pleasure today to interview Dr. Peter McCullough. Dr. Peter, thank you so much for being with me and taking this time to chat.
Thank you, Michael. Thanks for having me.
So, Dr. McCullough, why don't you share with us who you are and where you're from? I most recently enjoyed a video I saw of yours, and I think the information you have to share is great, but why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I can tell you, Michael, I never expected to become a media personality in medicine. I'm a practicing doctor in internal medicine and cardiology. I'm a professor of medicine in Dallas, Texas, and I'm an academic doctor. I'm the president of the Cardiorenal Society of America. I'm the editor of Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine and Cardiorenal Medicine, two separate journals. I've just published my first overall book on cardiorenal medicine. It's the initial inaugural textbook, very first edition. And I've published over 600 papers in the National Library of Medicine, and I'm considered one of the most published and one of the greatest contributors to modern day medicine. I've worked very hard to be an unbiased evaluator of evidence. And when COVID-19 hit, I knew this was a big deal. I felt it, and I went after it hard from a scholarship perspective and a clinical perspective. And working with teams all over the world, I led the early treatment initiative in the United States, and it spread worldwide. And so the great news to Canadians today is COVID-19 is a treatable illness in high-risk patients. We treat patients at home. We avoid hospitalization and death. And that's probably the biggest breakthrough we've had in all of COVID-19.
So Dr. McCullough, that's actually something I really appreciated about when I first saw you giving information, was this discussion about early treatment. Particularly, you distinguish between outpatient and inpatient, which was very helpful, because you've talked about so many people not going home with instructions, but just waiting to go back into the hospital. Can you unpack for us your concern for the lack of care going on? And can you try to paint the landscape a little bit about what's really been going on with outpatient care in North America? And just so our viewers know, can you share with us your connection to Canada? Because sometimes Canadians have a little bit of a little brother syndrome, little sister syndrome to our American counterparts, but you're quite connected to our wonderful country. So why don't you share a little bit about that?
Well, sure. I grew up in Buffalo, New York, right across the border from Canada as a kid. And my wife is a Torontonian. She grew up in Toronto. Went to school all the way through grade 13 in Toronto. My kids are dual citizens, U.S. and Canadian. My wife's parents live in Toronto. They're quite elderly, and they've been in lockdown for over a year. So my wife every day scrambles to try to get them groceries and healthcare. So we are very involved in what's going on in Canada, and really quite disturbed on how many blunders they've made in the pandemic. So for instance, the testing. Do you know that none of the COVID testing that's done with the nose or the mouth and the swabs, none of that is approved by any agency for asymptomatic screening? So how can the Canadian government detain people for 2 weeks and put them through an asymptomatic screening protocol? They don't have a single leg to stand on from a regulatory legal perspective. So why is the Canadian government overstepping the bounds just on safety?
That's something that why don't you explain that a little bit more? When you say this testing has not been approved, do you mean that it hasn't been, there's been no medical trials, or what do you mean by it hasn't been approved? Because I think Canadians would be shocked to think that they're doing something unethical or rapid. Mm-hmm. Can you explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, well, the government authorities in Canada are doing something that's unethical, and that is utilizing a test for which it has no approval. And so what happens is when a company makes a test, they actually have to do a research study to show how the test is used. And so So all the companies did research studies on the COVID-19 tests in acutely sick people to see if they could diagnose COVID-19 in acutely sick individuals. None of the companies ever did a study in asymptomatic people getting off the airplane, going through Toronto Pearson Airport, and to see if the test does anything to help the situation in identifying COVID-19. And we know from two very good studies now, one from China, from Cao et al., and one from published out of the UK in Madewell. These are very well done studies. Asymptomatic individuals, people with no symptoms, they don't spread the virus. And even if it happens to be there, which is really, really rare, less than 1% of the time, even if it happens to be there, they form immunity to it and they're not going to spread it anyway. So there is no medical justification. There is no regulatory justification. It's illegal from a regulatory perspective for the Canadian government to detain anybody at the border and put them into hotels.
So you've used the word regulatory a few times, and I appreciate that. Are you aware of this, the statements from the regulatory bodies in Ontario towards doctors and nurses? Are you aware that the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario have a statement saying that physicians hold a unique position of trust with the public and have a professional responsibility not to communicate anti-vaccine, anti-masking, anti-distancing, and anti-lockdown statements and or promoting unsupported, unproven treatments for COVID-19? That's on the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Ontario. And the nurses, the College of Nurses of Ontario has almost the exact same statement. Nurses are leaders in the community, and the public's trust in nurses may extend to their views on health matters. So nurses have a professional accountability to use, and they go on and they list what they have to do, and they have to support patients and the public to make informed health decisions, including decisions about public health prevention. And it just goes on and on to say they're expected to adhere to the practices carried out by the professional by their professional responsibilities, and not to publicly communicate anti-vaccine, anti-masking, anti-distancing statements that contradict the available scientific evidence. That is, I'm literally reading off of our College of Nurses of Ontario. These statements gag doctors from disagreeing with the regulatory bodies.
It's the way it's presented. It's the way it's presented that is, it gives a sense of misinformation, right? So you just read the Canadian authorities say, well, if you say anything that's anti-masking, but at the very end, they say, but follow the most recent data. Well, the most recent data is actually supports that masks don't work. Masks are not my signature issue. I wear a mask every day at work, and I anticipate I'll be doing that for the rest of my career. It doesn't bother me. But what does bother me is that if Canadians get sick with COVID-19, their doctors should be treating them with the most up-to-date and available regimens. I've published the two most cited and utilized papers and protocols that exist in the American Journal of Medicine in 2020 and Reviews in Cardiovascular Medicine in 2020. There's another kind of less intense protocol that's presented and published by the Frontline Critical Care Consortium. But there's others that exist. But Canadians should be receiving early treatment, and they should be getting a fair, balanced message on vaccine safety and efficacy.
Yeah, I in these statements, that's certainly not the way it feels to me, a novice outside of the medical community. In fact, we regularly hear stories of physicians saying, oh, well, I disagree with this and I disagree with that, but I've been told I can't say anything. That those statements, the weight of those statements don't actually land where you've just landed with the weight. The weight of the statement is you're not allowed to say anything anti. So it's like they're stopping to read, and it also is, it's like they're ignoring their oath to their patients to treat the patient and not to follow some top down. Like I find myself in an ironic position when I'm talking to doctors like you who I agree with, and I appreciate your perspective. And then on the same, you know, or on the other hand, I want to be able to say, but wait a minute, I thought we were allowed to get second opinions with authoritative doctors that I disagree with. I thought I was allowed to reject any medical procedure that I don't want to happen, whether 200,983 Dr. Peters tell me it would be good for me. I still thought I had the ability to say no to that. But in Canada, we're talking about vaccine passports. We're still in complete lockdown. We've just moved to step one, I think, tomorrow to our reopening, which is not really a step in any real direction. It's a little bit of a difference, but your parents in Toronto won't feel that much of a difference when we move into this. I appreciate what you're saying, where we are in complete agreement, or I'm following you when you're saying, hey, I've got all the medical evidence. Anyone can read this, because that's something I appreciated in one of your videos. You said anyone can go read this and see this. And I thank you for that. So how does a guy like me, who's a pastor in a church, who faces 2 years in prison and up to $200,000 in fines simply for opening my church while Walmart was open down the street, how do I balance this world of doctors speaking authoritatively and then maybe doctors speaking with like a dictatorship, authoritarianism behind? Like, how do we balance that out? And even as a Christian man, like, how do I balance that out? You know, if I were to get up in front of my church and dogmatically say every person must do this, I would expect my people to study the scriptures and see whether I was right or wrong and to live by their own conscience before God. So can you help us navigate that a little bit? Because I know there is the authority of the medicine, and then there is freedom of conscience. Can you help us walk that through a little bit?
Well, let's take the church. I'm not a pastor, but I'm certainly a church member. And I can tell you the Methodist Church in America, certainly in Dallas, Texas, prohibited in-person services inside the church. What did we do? Did we shut down? No, we went out in the parking lot. You could hold a sermon out in the parking lot. You know, God's kingdom is not defined by brick and mortar. God's kingdom is not defined by what some government authority can tell you to do or what not to do. And the same thing is true in medicine. There is a fiduciary relationship that a doctor has with a patient that is unbreakable. It is absolutely unbreakable. When that patient asks that doctor for advice, that advice cannot be influenced or distorted, or actually made to be bad advice by outside agencies. It just can't. That's the reason why there's a medical license. That's the reason why there's malpractice insurance. And doctors have to live up to their Hippocratic oath. These aren't hard things. If a patient had asthma and the patient was having trouble breathing, the doctor would have no problem prescribing an inhaler and some oral steroids. The same thing with a patient with COVID-19. If they're having trouble breathing, the doctor should have absolutely no reservations about prescribing an inhaler and some oral steroids. There should be absolutely no problem. That what's happened is it's gotten into people's minds that this is a virus. Somehow the government is using this virus to exert tremendous control. There's almost a trance over the way people think. And I anticipate when this is all over with and people come out of their trance, they're going to be horrified at the things that happened. That, oh, we threatened ministers with these terrible fines. We threatened doctors. And you know what? Doctors that have their minds open right now, that have their eyes cleared, including myself, we are going to be absolutely without mercy on these authorities. And I want them to hear it. Without mercy, because the long arm of the law is going to root out all of these injustices, all of these fractures of regulatory law, fractures of personal freedom, fractures of the fiduciary relationship, all these intentional breakages that are going on. those individuals who are really carrying this out are going to pay an extraordinary price because it is so clear about right and wrong. So the authorities that were using diagnostic tests that were never approved to try to identify asymptomatic individuals. And the study suggests when you do it, you generate more false positives than negative. Those individuals who did that and created all the damages and hardship, what have you, will pay a price. All of those regulators that basically put a chill on Canadian doctors not treating COVID patients, leading to hospitalization and death, all of those lines of, quote, authority, anonymous authority right now, will be rooted out. They will be found out, and they will pay a heavy price. All of those college administrators who are right now, quote, forcing vaccination to go to college, but they don't have a policy or they don't have exemptions. Can you imagine that? You know what that's called? That's called bullying. That's called intimidation. Why don't they have a rule, Michael, to say that they're not going to take American Indian students? Wait a minute, where's your policy? We don't have one. Every single one of these is going to be absolutely scorched. Our government agencies say this vaccine program is completely elective. Our agencies have told us they're not taking the vaccine. How in the world can they possibly say, quote, where a university say they're requiring the vaccine? It's impossible.
So this comes back to this point about authoritarianism, and you've talked about it. You talked about it in your March 11th video where you were in front of the Senate Committee on Health and Human Services in Texas. So just walk me through the bizarro world you're living in when somebody from across the country, very far away, makes one call and then all medical discussion is shut down. Is that really, has that been happening in the US? Have you been talking to anybody in Canada where you used a phrase just a second ago, you know, those who are executing this or those who are doling this out? How is it happening that one perspective is, you know, it's almost like Lord of the Rings, like one ring to rule them all. Like, how is it that one perspective is silencing the medical community from at least practicing medicine, where we're trying to get early treatment to people? This doesn't work. Like, my son's a cancer survivor. We had we would have briefings with our oncology team on a daily basis. They'd come in and touch base. They'd go have a discussion as a group. How has this happened?
Doctors are an amazing trance. And I think when they come out of their hypnosis, they're going to be shocked. They're going to be shocked. If I was to tell you in 5 years that we took a pregnant woman, the most cherished and fragile of all of our patients, and I see and examine pregnant women, I perform consultations on pregnant women, I know what I'm talking about. If I told you that we had pregnant women and that obstetricians were recommending that they get injected with an investigational, genetically oriented and genetically engineered messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA, where we have no proven clinical benefit, and they were excluded from clinical trials based on the concerns that they would be harmed. They were excluded by J&J, Pfizer, AstraZeneca, and Moderna. With the agencies, they're excluded. And these same obstetricians in Canada and the United States were turning around and telling the women to take an injection. When these doctors come out of their slumber, when they come out of their hypnosis, they're going to be horrified. Very similar to how Nazi war crime doctors and Nazi doctor researchers came out of their trance and were horrified in what they did. This is a horror. This is an absolute and complete horror that these doctors are complicit with. It's even more horrifying that a pregnant woman would ever do this. I saw something, and don't forget, it's not doctors who are in a trance and brainwashed only. It's the citizens. They are in a trance. I have seen pictures on the internet where there's a young pregnant woman and she says, well, I won't even have half a glass of wine because I'm worried about my baby. But she'll turn around and take an injection of messenger RNA that's synthetic, where there's absolutely no information we're finding out about these injections is not good. It is astonishing the trance that people are in. And I think that there's a lot of parallelisms to Nazi Germany. People were in a trance. The very first families that volunteered their children up for euthanasia and eugenics, they did it for the good of society. They thought it was really good. There are people who are getting vaccinated because they think it's good for society. It has such a strong parallelism with Nazi Germany. But instead, this time, they're putting their life on the line. So every single person who's gotten an injection of messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA, they have to be asked, what did this do to your body? What do you think your benefit is? What do you think your risks were or are going to be? Where does this genetic information go in your body? How long does it stay there? How does it get out of the body? It's amazing.
And to follow up with that, if I heard you correctly, you just said that these women would have been denied to be a part of the clinical trial. But the whole thing's a clinical trial, right? Like,
But the registrational clinical trials to even get emergency authorization, they had to exclude groups and justify to the FDA and justify to the ethics boards why they're excluding them. And pregnant women were obviously excluded because they thought the pregnant women would be harmed. You know, they excluded COVID recovered and suspected COVID recovered because they thought the vaccine wouldn't have any benefit because they're already immune. I mean, our director of our agencies, a bunch of emails have been leaked, have said, listen, he knows that once you get the virus, you're completely immune. So everybody knew that anybody who had the previous infection was completely immune. They knew that the vaccine would have no benefit. So this idea of even being complicit in this idea that, oh, COVID recovery should be vaccinated, go ahead and vaccinate pregnant women. Based on what judgment? It's not. I think people are in a trance right now. The best way to describe it is brainwashed. People are brainwashed.
Well, certainly, you and I would agree that mainstream media and the tech giants, the social media tech giants, have tried very hard. If you were to look on my Facebook page today, a video of yourself was up for moments. And then if you wouldn't even believe it, Facebook has like a better doctor on staff than you writing algorithms. And within just an hour, they knew that your hour and a half briefing video was just totally debunked. They knew it. And they pulled you from my personal Facebook feed. We will today, putting this video up, just so you know, Dr. Peter, we will actually, your video will be deleted. And we are, our Liberty Coalition Canada channel may be actually removed completely from YouTube because they keep telling me that I am talking to dangerous people.
They know this is actually a very good sign. They know that I have the moral, ethical, and clinical authority to make these statements. They know that. They know that. And they probably have some Chinese medical student trying to sift through everything and X things out. The bottom line is we have a real problem on our hands when our top doctors are being scrubbed from social media. Everything I do is evidence-based. Everything I do is cited and referenced. Your viewers can go to America Out Loud Talk Radio and go to the McCullough Report. And everything I've said today will be in the McCullough Report. It's all cited. We have bulletproof platforms. And I think people are going to move to this. But of interest, the trance or the brainwashed neurosis that's come down on the world is not all through social media. I can tell you, I get distressed phone calls and emails every day, hundreds of them, and they're coming from some of the tiniest places in the world that don't even know what Facebook is. They don't even know what the FDA is or the Royal College is. They don't. And it's just like during Nazi Germany, without social media, without Facebook, somehow Japan got in the mindset of Nazi Germany. They did. So did Italy. They became, so there is a mental phenomenon where people can come under a trance, if you will. And they wake out of the trance. People in Japan were horrified at what they did. They're like, oh my gosh, how could we think this way? I mean, we had kamikaze pilots. When people come out of their trance in the US, Canada, and most of the world, they're going to be horrified at what they did. And let's hope the vaccines don't look as bad as they do now, because if this continues, this is going to go down as probably one of the greatest medical catastrophes and atrocities, human atrocities of all time.
I'd like to ask you two questions about that. Before we get to the vaccine, I want to maybe talk about our Christian faith. So I think one of the things, particularly with propaganda, and again, remember listeners, that when someone makes a parallel to Nazism, it is immediately discarded as alarming, over the top, shock type of an analogy. But it is a recent historical event that we are able to look and see the documented writings, analysis. We can see everything from that event. So particularly, I am thinking, Dr. McCullough, when you're sharing on that, I'm thinking of a book I just read called The Radio Signal. And it's a story of a young Polish woman and a young German man who fall in love in the middle of the war, and they're trying to get out of the occupied Germany ahead of the Red Army coming across and sweeping in. And the radio signal is simply the fact that there's only one radio channel, and it is constantly declaring victory over the war, and it is constantly repeating the same information. And one of the things that happened in Germany was the silencing of any opposing voice to that radio signal. And so I do think your analogy is so appropriate, and we are concerned with this propaganda. And the connection to our Christian faith is, of course, we are told in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not lie. You shouldn't lie. And this is one of the things that triggered many of the pastors in Canada to make the decisions that we have been making. We just cannot lie that the ongoing narrative of fear, the ongoing narrative of we can do nothing, the ongoing narrative that every voice should be silenced if it's not coming from one body. Ironically, so many Canadians are just following Fauci just as the Americans would have. How does that fall in for you, Dr. Peter, when you're talking about having moral authority, the command not to lie? You know, was there mm-hmm. a moment when you just said, look, I can't be complicit in any way. I've got to get out there and be vocal. How did that work for you?
Well, I follow the principle of above all, do no harm. So, and I like to follow rules. Listen, you know, I'm an American. I pay my quarterly taxes. I drive and I follow the rules. I don't get traffic tickets. I'm a rule follower. And, you know, when we saw this evolving landscape about wearing masks, I wore masks. And there's no rule, believe it or not, there is no rule that says in America, there's no rule that says that doctors shouldn't treat COVID patients. There's no rule. There are medical rules. So for instance, doctors, let me give an example of a rule. A doctor could not do a procedure at a hospital which the doctor was not credentialed to do a procedure. So I'm a medical doctor. So if I walked into the hospital and said, listen, I'm going to take out a gallbladder and I'm not credentialed to do it, I'm breaking a rule. So there are doctors' rules that if a doctor breaks the rule, then there's consequences. But there is absolutely no rule that says that a doctor can't treat a COVID patient. And what's happened is through these means of communication, there's been a chilling. There's almost been like this. And of course, no one can actually identify who's the person doing it. Who's actually the person responsible for telling Canadian doctors in some way not to treat COVID-19? No one seems to know. They're never held accountable. I'd like to have a conversation with that person.
I would too.
So one time I had a communication with the National Institute. So I said, Dr. McCullough, you're kind of reorganizing healthcare for the United States. The NIH and FDA is not even involved. And they're right. We basically organized 4 national telemedicine services, 15 regional services. We got 500 treating doctors. We have the American Association of Physicians and Surgeons. We have guidance papers. We published protocols, and we did it. We're treating all the high-risk patients in the United States. We crushed the curves at the end of December, and the problem is solved. We took care of it. We took care of it. They just had a huge rally in Italy yesterday for the treatment domiciliary group led by Eric Grimaldi. They crushed it over there. They crushed it. That's fine. They've crushed the curve in India. They crushed the curve in Mexico City. So actually treating COVID-19 is a great thing. What I've said is that, listen, if anybody actually wants to oppose that, actually, I'd be happy to talk to them. When I had to communicate with intermediaries to the NIH, and then the staffer said, oh, we really are not telling Dr. McCullough he can't treat patients. In fact, on page 8, it says, even though we recommend certain things for the inpatients, it says in the end, doctors can decide what to do over in this paragraph. So something has come down where there's been a chilling effect without any accountability. So when you ask the universities who are stating that they're going to require the COVID-19 vaccine, and you say, well, who's actually saying that? And where's their policy? Well, we don't really know. It's very similar to Nazi Germany. It's like, who's actually really calling the shots here? And the Nazi Germany parallelisms, I think, are fine. In fact, a world's leading attorney, Rainer Fulmich in Germany, has filed crimes against humanity, and it's called Nuremberg 2.0. Nuremberg, Germany, the Nuremberg Code came out of the fact of forcing people into experimentation against their will. You know, this mass vaccine program, which is investigational, for it to have any coercion or any force to it. There are Canadians and Americans today who are signing up and getting the vaccine because they do feel forced into it. They don't want to do it, but they feel forced into it. They feel like they need to travel, or they feel an inducement. In the United States, it's so grotesque. They're offering $1 million in a lottery if someone will take the vaccine. If the vaccine was so good and was so safe, why would they ever have to offer $1 million?
Well, that's, I really want to get here. I really want to get to the vaccine because it's the elephant in the room for everyone. And what I mean by the elephant in the room is exactly what you're talking about. So I was on, I was out yesterday, and an older gentleman just voluntarily said to me, "Hey, have you got your shot?" And I think it was because I looked at him and he was rubbing his arm, and he said, you know, I got my shot and my arm's sore. And he said, "Hey, you get your shot." I said, "Look, you couldn't pay me, pin me down to get that thing. I'm a young, healthy man. I don't get the influenza vaccine ever. I'm pretty sure I've had COVID-19 because before it came out, before all of the hoopla came out, a lot of very similar symptoms came through our entire community. You couldn't. But the reason why I'm having such a strong reaction is because maybe I'm not like you. I'm not a rule follower. I'm a pastor who believes that I really need to be saved by Jesus because I actually love to break rules, and I need the scriptures to help me remember to be a rule follower. But all that to say, when every voice out there is telling me one thing and they're not being honest about it, it is coercion. Like, do you realize that within Canada right now, if you were to Google vaccine passports, it is everywhere in our media that our government is considering vaccine passports. If you turn on your television, there's government ads to go out and do the right thing. There's nobody saying in Canada, you should have the ability to pause and be careful about your own health. I'm not hearing any official, I'm not hearing any government employee saying that. I'm not hearing any physicians other than the ones who are already trying, like yourself, to get the message out. So let's get to the vaccine. So number one, you've already addressed it, the coercive nature of the layout. So do we need to go any further in that? Or do you want to comment on the propaganda again on what's going on? Like, it seems to me there was one solution to this problem, and it was always get everybody really scared until we have the ability to produce a vaccine that we get to solve the problem with. As a commons man perspective, what do you think? And maybe just talk about the coercion again, and then we'll move on to the actual vaccine itself.
Well, do you have drug advertisements on TV in Canada for certain drugs?
We do. And as I mentioned to you, we also have a ton of American stations. So I know exactly where you're going. It's going with and this may cause blah, 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 the whole ramble at the end of the fine print, right?
You know, that's regulatory law. And regulatory law says when a medical product is put on TV or advertised in some way, or actually administered to somebody, there must be information regarding safety. What could happen to you? Have you ever seen anything on any public messaging about safety of the vaccines? Have you personally?
Not even in the slightest. Even after we slowed down the delivery of one of the vaccines, even that week, people were tweeting out about the complete safety about it without any authorities were tweeting out without any information.
That's greatly concerning. So Canadians should think about, wait a minute, if they're going to advertise for a new drug on TV, they always have to give safety information. When Canadians pick up their prescriptions, there's what's called a package insert, or there's actually a piece of paper that gives all the safety, because you have to know this as a patient. For instance, you know, there's certain drugs that if you took it with another drug, there could be a problem. And so that's by law. Michael, that is a law that any biological or medical product must have safety information. So, you know, we should all be greatly concerned that anybody promoting the vaccine and anybody administering the vaccine is not giving Canadians fair, balanced information on safety. Matter of fact, they're not even telling them what to do if something happens. And this is extraordinary. What's going on is complete and total malfeasance. It's almost a direct assault on people's bodies at this point in time. How could it be worse? Here, come get a vaccine of completely experimental biological material developed in a rushed fashion and brought to you. And here is no safety information. Something happens to you, God help you.
Can I ask you a question about that? Also, because these are medical trials, I was talking to Dr. Mark Trozzi, and he mentioned that not only should there be safety information, and by the way, I really appreciate that point. Thank you for articulating it in that way. That hadn't even dawned on me in the propaganda wars. So thank you. He mentioned that if you're a part of a clinical trial, not only do you have to have information, but you actually have to sign off that you are a part of a clinical trial, and you have to be, certain information has to be laid out before you. Are you aware in the United States or in Canada if that's actually being done at these vaccine clinics? Or, you know, I don't want to create a straw man.
Yes. So, right. So in a research study, the consent form is typically 20 to 30 pages, and it actually has to lay out what is known about the product, where the previous problems have been in terms of, you know, having problems with the liver or bone marrow, et cetera. And it has to be laid out that, you know, that the risks and benefits are only partially known, but there's some information. It takes about 20 to 30 pages. The consent form in the United States for the emergency use authorization is pretty brief. And it does state this. It's actually a fair form. It says this vaccine is investigational. We don't know if it's going to work. It says that right in the consent form. And it says the side effects can be anything from a sore arm to death. In that range, it can be anything. So it's the most wide open consent form that any person has ever signed in history. And everybody who does get the vaccine actually does consent to be in an investigation. Investigation means research. So all research studies of a large scale must have a critical event committee. So when something happens to a patient, unbiased doctors evaluate it and have it completely assessed. There must be a data safety monitoring committee, which is completely separate from the stakeholders. So there'd be nobody within Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, AstraZeneca, nobody in the FDA, the CDC, the NIH, nobody in Health Canada, nobody in OHIP or the Royal College. It's got to be completely separate. Data Safety Monitoring Committee. There's a charter, and that charter is registered. It's registered. It's registered with all the regulatory authorities. And there must be a human ethics board. And the human ethics board is typically at each regional center, and they're looking at the ethics of what's going on to make sure what's being done is ethical. So those things, let me ask you, in Canada, is there a critical event committee, a day safety monitoring board, and an ethics committee?
I'm gonna have to ask some of the doctors that I'm speaking with later on today here from Canada about that question.
Ask them. So here's the first thing. Ask them. I can tell you in the United States, it doesn't exist.
Right.
But if you had these individuals, they would have meetings. They would have regular meetings, and they would produce the minutes of their meeting and make it public. So we would actually know what the concerns are. Because with any program, there is a fiduciary relationship between the program and the public who signed up for this for what's called risk mitigation. Risk mitigation means that everything's being done to keep people safe. And so you can ask yourself, look at what's going on in Canada. Look what's going on. Is everything being done to keep people safe?
Okay, so I want to follow up with this one, even though I really want to ask you about the vaccine itself, but I really want to follow up with this one because I'll say back to you, Dr. McCullough, leave us alone. We're in the middle of a pandemic. We're doing the best we can. We've got to rush it. We've got to rush it. So our Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, has literally said that constitutional freedoms, that needs to be set aside, not for now. I have had personal conversations with ER nurses that have said, all of these things, yep, these are normal things that we should be doing, but it needs to be set aside because we're in the middle of a pandemic and you are just being insensitive, you're being rude, and we've just got to get through the pandemic. So this is what we're doing. I think I know your answer, but I would really like you to speak to that point where you're saying, look, we've got to have some ethical implications. We got to have some oversight, no matter what we're doing. Please respond to the, it doesn't matter, all hands on deck. We got to get this out and stop slowing us down. Please respond to that mentality.
Well, if the mentality is, listen, it's all hands on deck, we've got to slow this down, then by golly, the authorities ought to be supercharging early treatment. They ought to be fortifying all the doctors with treatment packs. In fact, countries are doing that. Countries that are managing COVID-19 is all hands on deck. As soon as sick people get diagnosed, they hand them a kit with multiple drugs in it, in a baggie. They hand it to them. So the bottom line is, if it's all hands on deck, treat the problem. I agree with you. If it's all hands on deck, let's see it. Let's see some action in treating Canadians to prevent hospitalization and death. But the all hands on deck mentality, that it's like saying, listen, we're in a mass casualty operation here, is to treat the injured and sick. That's what the all hands on deck on. The all hands on deck is not to reach out to well people who are far from the action and start injecting them or masking them or torturing them or locking them down. The all hands on deck is treating the acute problem. So you can see how contorted and distorted this is, that we should suspend personal liberties. You know what they should do if they really care about suspending operations? Why don't they suspend the need for any prescriptions at all? Why don't they give protocols to the population and hand out the medicines? That would be real all hands on deck. That would actually be handling the problem. What I see and what you're describing is a suspension of civil liberties to do something to people who are not involved with COVID. They're talking about vaccinating people who you know, are very unlikely to ever come in contact with COVID. If you had a situation where you had 20% of the population dying of the illness, like we did in prior plagues and prior pandemics, you could make the case that there has to be suspension of civil liberties and the costs are too high, and you'd have to really, really force treatment on individuals. Remember, masks are not a treatment. Neither are lockdowns, and vaccines don't treat the problem. Vaccines are not a treatment. As people have to understand, vaccines are not a treatment. So if we're going to use this rationale and say that we're going to suspend civil liberties for this, the public should ask why. Why are we suspending civil liberties for a problem which affects less than 1% of Canadians, less than 1% are ever going to get COVID, way less than 1% are ever going to be hospitalized for it, and way, 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 way less than 1% are going to be less than are going to die of COVID. And why are we going to really go after populations where the chances are fundamentally zero? People under age 50 with health problems, COVID recovered, who absolutely positively cannot get it again. Children, pregnant women. The thing is so distorted. It's so misdirected. It's so grotesque. It's so obvious that the suspension of civil liberties is for some other reason besides COVID.
Well, thank you for saying that. You heard everyone, you heard somebody else say that other than me, who's been me and Tim, who've been ranting on our podcast about this. Let's talk about that. So let's get to the vaccine. So I am a relatively simple man. And early on, about over a year ago, a lot of the information about Fauci that is now finally being allowed to rise to the surface has been available for quite a long time. So to just look at the situation and say, okay, it seems to be a misdirected reaction. There seems to be a medical community that is in a trance. Everyone's scared to act. There seems to be an authoritarian push where our civil liberties are not important until we get to us, until we get somewhere. And that somewhere sure seems to be the unilateral push for a vaccine. Let's talk about it. So are you gonna get this vaccine? How are you dealing with the vaccine? You've already mentioned that there are certain age categories that you would not recommend the vaccine for. Why is that? We're hearing that I literally have people telling me the vaccine is the solution to this problem. So Dr. McCullough, why are you suggesting otherwise?
I can tell you the vaccine is not the solution to the problem for the following reasons. Less than 1% of people get COVID or are ever exposed to COVID. So anybody who got the vaccine, it's like an insurance policy. It's less than a 1% chance your house is going to get burned down this year, but you're going to get homeowner insurance. So the vaccine is an insurance policy. It's not a solution for acutely sick Canadians right now. Obviously, a vaccine doesn't treat the problem. So everyone should realize that the vaccine is kind of like an insurance policy. Okay. So the absolute benefit to the population is less than 1%. It's not going to make the epidemic curves go away. It can't. It's a less than 1% population effect. Now, on top of that, the vaccine doesn't completely work. And so people get COVID anyway. Very, very important. People get the vaccine, get COVID anyway. It doesn't completely work. People on a privileged vaccine passport are going to get sick and they're going to cough on other vaccinated patients, and they're all going to get sick together. Your neighbor who said, "Did you get vaccinated?" He could probably get COVID. If he gets exposed, he can get COVID. So the vaccines don't completely work. Our Centers for Disease Control tried to keep track of this. They got up to 10,000 cases because they don't have any system to capture this. They were doing it by phone call. It looked like regular old COVID. 9% were hospitalized, 3% died. It's COVID. So the vaccines don't work 100%. They're just not good enough to ever have a policy about having a passport or making college kids get it. They don't work good enough. And, you know, I've gotten these emails too, where someone says an email, I'm on a work group. Hey, everybody, team members, I got vaccinated. I hope you did too. And I emailed back. I said, listen, if you get COVID, we treat it no different than if you didn't get vaccinated. It's no different to me. It's the same illness, the same illness. And a few weeks ago, I think I had 10 patients in my practice with COVID at one time. Six of them were already fully vaccinated. So it doesn't work 100%. So it can't possibly be a solution to the problem. Now, the question is, can it help? And can it help? Well, it depends on risks and benefits. And as doctors, when we saw this coming out of the clinical trials, we thought maybe it could help. And as an internist and cardiologist, you know, I'm very pro-vaccine. I've gotten every vaccine. 98% of Americans get all the vaccines. I've already had two vaccines this year alone as an adult in my 50s. Fine. As the COVID-19 vaccines came out, I looked at the data, and about 70% of patients in my practice were vaccinated on December, January, and February. But then as the events came in, and these were scary, death, hospitalization, blood clots, more with Pfizer than Moderna than J&J, okay? Strokes, heart attacks, myocarditis in the kids, neurologic problems, babies being injured from breastfeeding women who had taken the vaccine. When we started seeing all these horrific things pouring in the United States, oh my Lord, there was great concern. You know, as we sit here today, we're over 4,000 American, or I'm sorry, over 5,000 Americans who have died. 46% on days 1, 2, and 3. If it was a new drug, at 5 deaths, there would have been a black box warning that would have come with each consent and package insert said, warning, may cause death. If we got to 50 deaths, the drug would probably be off the market, 50. We know in the United States per year, with hundreds of millions, probably 500 million or more shots, because each person gets multiple shots, we know the total number of deaths that ever get reported to the CDC, and it takes a doctor or a nurse to do it, and over 83% of the time, that's the case. It's a serious form. It takes half an hour to fill this out. That is reported, and then it has to get certified by the CDC. So I'm giving you certified numbers. I can tell you the total number of deaths, all vaccines per year in the United States is 200, less than 200, maybe 150, 160, 170. We have skyrocketed from 150 to 200 to 5,000 in 6 months. This is absolutely no doubt about it. It is the most deadly set of biologic products ever injected into a human body in history. And it just gets worse and worse and worse as we find out more information. These are genetic therapies that have never been tested before in human beings, never. They're either messenger RNA or adenoviral DNA injections. We were told initially that they stay right in the arm, and the body forms an immunity to it, kind of like a tetanus shot. Well, I can tell you a tetanus shot is an inactive protein from the tetanus bacteria, and it does stay in the arm, and you do form immunity to it. That tetanus shot is legit. This stuff, we found out in the last 2 weeks that it tricks the body into making the dangerous Wuhan spike protein. The spike protein was the target of gain of function bioterrorism research in this Wuhan lab in China. That's what they are working on. They were working on making a very dangerous spike protein that allowed the virus to jump from person to person. And then when it got in the body, the spike protein caused damage to blood vessels, caused blood clotting, injured the heart, the brain, the kidneys, the liver. It was a deadly weapon by design. These Pfizer, Moderna, J&J, and AstraZeneca actually trick the body into making this weapon of bioterrorism and have your body produce it. And then your body circulates it for 2 weeks. We never thought it circulated for 2 weeks. In fact, some people it circulated for a couple months. And it is directly responsible for all that we see: direct death, hospitalization for blood clots, neurologic damage, heart attacks in children, myocarditis, kidney failure. It's terrible. And then the information just keeps coming out, getting worse and worse. We realized in the United States that there was no restrictions on blood donation. So we've had people vaccinated donating blood, and we think we have the entire U.S. and probably the Canadian blood supply is contaminated with spike protein. So if you're sick in the hospital getting a blood transfusion, last thing you want is the Wuhan spike protein, the gain of function research product in your blood that's going into your body. So this is a disaster. So we have emergency letters going off to the American Association of Blood Banking, the American Red Cross. This is a disaster. Last night, the Germans published the first autopsy of a fully vaccinated patient. It was a gentleman in his 80s. He was fully vaccinated. It was about 25 days later. He got COVID, again, because the vaccine doesn't work. He gets COVID. And then it looks like he dies of what looks like, in the end, an aspiration pneumonia. The COVID had not really set in the organs yet. But the most disturbing thing about that paper, Michael, is that the messenger RNA was everywhere in the body. It didn't break down. We were told it was going to break down. It was broken down by RNAases, that the body literally had this for a couple of days. You had a local reaction and that was it. That's not the case, Michael. This stuff looks like, at least in this autopsy, it stays in the body a long time and God knows what it's doing.
So I think right there you had a theological moment. Yes, God does know what he's done when he created the body. And we humans have always been cautioned, even from the Old Testament scriptures, about meddling too much and mixing and splicing too much. Can you help me understand how my body produces a protein just for a few weeks because it's been tricked? So number one, you said it was presumed to be a very short time, but now they're discovering at least up to 2 weeks and in some cases longer. Can you explain two things for me? Number one, why would my body start producing it and then just not continue to produce it? And then number two, Is there any issue other than me potentially having an immunity response? If I'm just out in the grocery store with other people, like, is it giving me COVID? How long is it being produced? And am I walking around with asymptomatic spread, or is it like, if I don't have symptoms, can you kind of walk through that a little bit? Just because these are the concerns that are on people's minds. If they're concerned about the vaccine, they're concerned about seeing other people who have been vaccinated. They're worried, someone gets the vaccine, sees your video and goes, oh, I'm not sure. They're wondering about how long does this affect my body? Please share any information you have on that again. And maybe you're going to repeat yourself, but I just want our listeners to be able to understand this as well as we can.
Okay, let's take the natural infection. The natural infection, one gets a broad base of immunity to all parts of the virus, the spike protein, the nucleocapsid, enzymes. So there probably are thousands of antibodies that are generated across the entire virus. And not only that, but there's a thousand or more different changes in T cells and B cells and plasma cells, T helper cells, natural killer cells, so we can handle the infection again. So then the people who are COVID recovered are completely immune. You can never get it again. Never get it again. Completely immune. That is the natural immune response. And in order to do that, the human body does make messenger RNA. It's made within plasma cells, and the plasma cells make the antibodies. Here, this is different. The synthetic messenger RNA gets inserted to cells, and cells that are not supposed to produce antibodies, it looks like they produce antibodies, which is kind of spooky. And so we know from a release from the Pfizer regulatory document dossier from Japan that alarmingly, the lipid particle that circulates, that helps the messenger RNA circulates in a very unusual pattern, accumulates in the ovaries over 48 hours in a progressively increasing manner where it actually washes out of the other organs. So it's very disturbing that somehow the organs are targeted by at least the Pfizer product. I assume the Moderna product as well. It's also alarming that in the Moderna regulatory application to the European Medical Agency that fertility was reduced in animals, and it didn't hit the threshold to actually stop the program, but it was pretty large reduction in fertility. So we're having some circumstantial pieces of evidence not look good at all about female fertility. And as you mentioned, we've heard innumerable reports about changes in menstrual periods, postmenopausal women having vaginal bleeding, certainly abortions, miscarriages, stillbirths when pregnant women are needlessly vaccinated. So things are not looking very good there. The situation that we have messenger RNA that we think the body, normally a messenger RNA would last, I don't know, a few hours or a few days, and it's broken down. Proteins within the cells typically have an exhaustion cycle of about 24 hours. Things don't last very long.
Okay.
But to find messenger RNA, synthetic messenger RNA in this autopsy, in this man from Germany, 25 days later, to find in the Ogata paper from Harvard, some individuals who are making spike proteins 60 days later is disturbing. I think scientists and doctors should be feeling very disturbed by seeing this. These are not good signs. Now, we do know the vaccines cause a tremendous elevation in the spike protein antibodies only, about 50 of them. And it looks like those antibodies have some beneficial effect. It's obviously not 100% because that man and so many people get COVID anyway after being vaccinated. So it's not 100%, but it may protect some people. So as I said, about 70% of my patients became vaccinated. As the alarming safety data came in, I no longer generally recognize, I don't recommend the vaccine as a general recommendation. I don't think any doctor should generally recommend it. It's not, doesn't have the safety profile that a doctor in good conscience can do that. Would we consider the vaccine on a risk-benefit balance for any given individual going forward? Sure. But the vaccines have been dropping since April 8th. The desperation to get people vaccinated is extraordinary. So we're seeing, you know, million-dollar raffles. We're seeing ice cream cones and trying to lure the kids out. We're seeing atrocities of coercion. Atrocities. These are gross atrocities of coercion. In the United States, in one of the states, they approved 12-year-olds can make their own decisions. So they're going to try to get the 12-year-olds in the school and then pressure them with their peers, threaten them with not participating in sports in order to vaccinate them. These are gross atrocities that we'll look back on. Michael, we need to make some notes. Let's look back on this. Just like we are in Nazi Germany and we're seeing gross atrocities going on in Nazi Germany, we're seeing gross atrocities going on in the United States and Canada. I mentioned before that ice cream cone episode somewhere in Canada where they lured the kids with ice cream cones and tried to vaccinate them. These are gross things. Any reasonable person ought to be thinking about this and saying, wait a minute, these are injections that could kill any person that goes into them and in fact has killed them. And then we don't know the long-term effects. They were only studied for 2 months. How can we possibly do anything more than just make it an offering with a very neutral recommendation? The moral authority should err on the side of safety, safety, safety. Caution, caution, caution. Primum non nocere. That's the moral authority of doctors, of agency officials, parents, community leaders, pastors. The moral authority is to do no harm. There is no moral authority to pressure, coerce, or threaten with a vaccine that has already been shown to kill, to put people in the hospital, that has no long-term safety information whatsoever. And every single thing we find out about it becomes more disturbing.
Okay, so I have two final questions for you. The first question is are you talking to any physicians in Canada? Are you mentioned in one of your videos about McGill University. Are you sensing that there's a community in Canada speaking up that I might not be aware of? So that would be a first question. Are you talking to people in Canada at all, physicians in Canada?
Well, Canadian physicians do participate in a group called C19 that I formed in the United States. It's about 1,000 people worldwide. They are participating in PANDA, the other worldwide COVID coalition. And these coalitions are all about evaluating the science, early treatment to prevent hospitalization, death, and vaccine safety. And all of us and many people in C19 have received the vaccine. They're extremely concerned about vaccine safety. But that's what we're all about. So there are outspoken leaders. Stephen Malthus in British Columbia Ira Bernstein in Toronto, Jennifer Hibbert in Toronto, Mark Keeley in Toronto, who's a business leader, groups in Montreal. You know, I mentioned, you mentioned one of the Montreal University's McGill. They actually wrote a, I think, a letter to the editor in my American Journal of Medicine paper, which was the first breakthrough paper that said, listen, we can treat COVID-19. And the general theme of the letter was, Dr. McCulley, you can't do this. You don't have enough evidence. And I could just see them trembling as they typed that on the keyboard. The sheer fear in a doctor is so visible. It's so revealing. And I was very nice to them. I said, listen, overcome your fear, you know, overcome your complete and total terror of this virus and join me in compassionately treating patients with COVID-19. I think a lot of this is driven out of fear. I think doctors were afraid of getting the virus itself. And it was only the doctors that really had guts. And there, you know, a lot of the early treatment doctors like myself, we got the virus. There's a couple of us that ended up in the hospital. One person's on the ventilator right now. You want to talk about real guts. Real guts is not force vaccinating kids against their will. Real guts is stepping out there and treating the infection. These are the heroes of the world right now. And I can tell you, whether it's some Facebook college kid trying to censor me or somebody on YouTube or what have you, they absolutely positively are scared to death. They're scared to death of the moral and ethical authority of doctors who have courage to face the virus and handle the problem head on. And I can tell you, any single one of those who has ever attempted to ever engage with me has cowered in fear. They're nowhere close to touching me.
I'm so glad I'm so glad the conversation actually came to courage, because that was one of my last questions. How did Texas open up? You guys have been wide open. Florida and Texas, of course, took the lead as far as I'm aware. I remember Biden on the news literally saying that these are Neanderthal moves, that people are going to die. So a major ingredient to virtue, a major ingredient to living a morally based life is the courage to follow your convictions. So can you share how Texas opened up? Were you a part of Texas reopening? Tell us a celebration story of courage and leadership so that we can inspire maybe a doctor or two who might listen to this podcast.
Well, I mentioned I grew up in Buffalo, New York. I moved down here with my family as a kid after my dad lost his job up in Buffalo. And so I consider myself a longstanding Texan. I went to college and medical school here. And Texas, I went to Baylor University, actually the current national champions in basketball. Baylor's the oldest university in Texas and actually was founded during the 10-year period where Texas was its own country. It was the Republic of Texas. So Texas has always had an independent attitude. It's a huge state. We've got a coastline. We've got prairies. We've got forests. We've got mountains. We've got desert. And Texas is a completely independent-minded state. Now, we have a massive number of impoverished immigrants. We have a confluence of different cultures, huge cities. We've got at least two of the largest metro areas in the United States. So if any state was going to get hit with COVID-19, it was Texas. And in fact, we got our share of COVID-19, but we always remained open. We were an early treatment state. We had many doctors independent enough that said, you know, I don't care. I'm treating this illness. I got enough guts to treat the illness where other doctors don't. And the Texans, they put on their cowboy boots. They get out there, they get in their pickup trucks and they go out there and they take care of business. And they did with COVID. And we treated COVID. I treated every one of my high-risk patients, everyone. I didn't deny my patient treatment, let them go in the hospital and die. I think Canadian doctors who are doing that should be ashamed of themselves. They can't even look at me. That's how shameful they are for not treating their patients. We've had 600,000 patients in the United States die. Every single one of them probably made a desperate phone call to their doctor who denied them early treatment. Shame on those doctors. Anybody who wants to take me on, bring them on. They have no discussion with me. They couldn't even lift a finger to prescribe some prednisone or easy medicine like that to ease them through the illness. That's shameful. These doctors should be absolutely ashamed. They're more worried about their standing in their medical center or some false a threat against their medical license. What a bunch of spineless, gutless zero integrity doctors that we have out there. I'm ready to take them all on. In fact, you got me fired up, Michael. I can't take any more of this. But Texas never shut down. On March 10th, I testified in the Texas Senate. I used standard CDC equations. I said, guess what? We're at 80% herd immunity. The chairman of the committee said, what? I'll have to check your calculations.
I watched that.
One of the public health officials.
I watched that literally this morning just to get prepped for this. And your account of it is 100% accurate. You were literally using the numbers in front of you. And her response was to immediately question you. Well, oh, I'm not sure about that. I'll have to check it. Like who are you across the, like, yeah.
Well, guess what? Guess what? She checked it and they agreed. Yeah, we're at 80% herd immunity. Now, it doesn't mean COVID's over. It just means it's not going to spread very far. We're not going to get these huge rises anymore. We knew that basically we're kind of on the back end of the pandemic. Early treatment crushed COVID-19 December and January before anybody was fully vaccinated. So the vaccine is going to have zero effect. In fact, we opened the Arlington Stadium for the baseball opener, packed it full. No, you know, there's no mask or any rest of that stuff. And believe me, our public health officials were all over that. We have this great system. They were going to report every single outbreak that came from the baseball opener. Nothing, nothing. Restaurants are open. Our economy is open. If the problem comes up, we treat it. The way Texas has dealt with this and the way that Florida have dealt with this with our huge population, Florida has a huge elderly population. Talk about a risk for mortality. But they had JJ Roster down there. They had leaders that were treating COVID-19 with ivermectin-based approaches, steroids, anticoagulants. And the bottom line is, if we just treat the problem, you can open up and manage through this. Again, I'm not against the vaccine. Patients have been appropriately vaccinated, and hopefully, you know, some people unfortunately have been injured, but the people who got the vaccine, I'm hoping they got some good out of it, something out of it. It's obviously it doesn't stop COVID 100%, but hopefully there's some benefit. But people should not be walking around like they've done something fantastic in promoting the vaccine. It's not nearly as important as early treatment.
You got me onto another topic. So if I've got you for a few more moments, I'm going to ask you, lockdowns. Again, I am a common man, but I have been putting up my hand in our community saying, if anybody has COVID, come over to my house so we can all get it and make sure we've had it. Am I just being an obnoxious jerk? But I always thought that herd immunity was going to be the solution to this. And we are doing the exact opposite. We are locking, I've read a number of studies that say lockdowns do no help. They may slow the spread, but that won't change the mortality rates. And so lockdowns just inevitably keep you from getting herd immunity. Is that a right assumption? Is that accurate information? Do you want to comment on the lockdown philosophy, or should we wrap it up and we stay away from it?
Well, I'll just tell you what I tell my patients. If they're sick with COVID-19, they should stay at home. If the other family members can get out, they should get out. And then we treat COVID-19 at home. And people over 50 with medical problems, we treat it with a sequenced, what's called multi-drug approach, with drugs we call in at the pharmacy and using nutraceuticals. Age under 50, we just have people stay at home until they pass the virus. And it can be as short as 4 days in kids. Sometimes kids under age of 15, it's literally just a runny nose for half a day. I mean, COVID-19 is nothing in children. If you're sick, stay at home. You don't have to lock down, but stay at home. I had COVID-19. I stayed in the house a few days and I went outside and I just stayed away from people, get some fresh air. But anything beyond that, like locking down well people, like why would well people who are not sick, why would they have to be locked down? No, well people should be out driving the economy and what have you. It doesn't have any medical basis. It doesn't have any medical basis whatsoever. And of course, when studied, all it does is make things worse. But so what people need to know is if COVID-19 comes in your house, stay at home. If you can, somebody can get away fine without getting it, but 85% of people get it, comes in the house. There's always one or two people who don't get it because they're naturally immune or they've already had it. And we just treat through the illness. If we just did this, we should never lock down, keep our economies open, and if you're sick, stay home. It's just very common sense. Dr. McCullough is giving common sense for Canada and the United States. And if people follow my advice, things would be so much better than following these types of directives, which are very damaging. And again, we never know who's the person giving the directive. No one will ever stand up. It's kind of, well, the CDC says, or Health Canada says, well, who's actually saying that? Nobody even knows. What's their peer review? Nobody even knows. Do you see what I mean? It's the type of thing that's very, it's very disturbing. It's kind of coming from some amorphous source. And in the end, I think the only way to break things is people just to go out and say, sorry, you know, sorry. And if everybody did it, it's just, there's nothing that anybody can do. We're just going to have to move on. And in fact, that's happening in a lot of places where people just say, sorry,
Well, Dr. McCullough, you know the situation in Canada because of your parents being here in Toronto. Hey, if your folks ever need any help, we've got some churches in the area who can get there and help out. But if you would be praying for us, we are our Ontario premier just put forward a motion in our parliament to extend the emergency lockdowns until December 1st.
Oh, so December 1st. That's a long time.
And there are variations of lockdown, but what that means is that our civil liberties are extended certainly till December 1st, are you know, at the whim of, as you say, this ominous voice that nobody can truly identify. We do not seem to be following the example of our American counterparts. We seem to be continuing further and further down this rabbit hole of lockdown. And, you know, the way that I've been thinking about things is I wouldn't be asking for emergency measures if I wasn't intending on using them at the next viral season. So I fully anticipate Ontario going into another lockdown again in the cold and flu season here in Ontario. So, you can be praying for us that we'd start following some of your courageous habits. I'm thankful for your time. And doctors, nurses, Christian leaders, mayors, these medical bureaucrats, friends, please, let's be courageous. Let's start treating COVID-19 the way that Dr. McCullough is talking about outpatient care treatment. And let's get back to not living in this this trance that we're in fear. So Dr. McCullough, thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
And thank you. Everybody, make sure you go to Liberty Dispatch, download our podcast on Apple iTunes or Spotify. Make sure you try to view this video on YouTube. If you can, good for you. We'll see how long they leave it up. If not, head over to Rumble where we're posting our videos now that these videos are being canceled. Thank you again, Dr. McCullough. Have a great day.
Thanks for tuning in to this Liberty Coalition Canada interview, working together for liberty and justice in Canada. Please subscribe to our podcast and YouTube channel, as well as visit our website at www.libertycoalitioncanada.com